You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to two investigative journalists about how problems with water quality in Wisconsin will affect fall elections here in the state. First, if this acoustic version of Birdland agrees with you, that might say something not just about your taste in music, but about your personality as well. Scientist and musician John Powell holds a PhD in physics from Imperial College at London University and a master's degree in music from the University of Sheffield in Great Britain. He's the author of the book How Music Works, and his new book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, are we wired to appreciate music of some sort or another as humans?
Generally, yes. Thankfully, most of us are. There are a few people who are genuinely tone deaf, who can't tell whether a tune's going up or down. But that's only about 3% of the population. The rest of us, if you think about your body having a sort of internal pharmacy, which dispenses various chemicals to make you run away from danger or go to sleep, then music has the key to the pharmacy. It can actually help dispense these chemicals when they're required, or stop ones that, if you're having trouble sleeping, for example, you've got too much of a chemical called noradrenaline in your system, and just listening to classical music quietly before you go to bed can stop that problem and cure insomnia.
Huh. Now, just because we are wired, most of us, to appreciate music doesn't mean we'll like any and all kinds of music. What kind of things, and this is a lot about what your book's about, what kind of things determine what kind of music I like versus what kind of music John Powell likes?
Well, we might like the same stuff. We can't tell.
Could be.
But, we could tell if we've met. Yes, by the 1990s, psychologists had come to the conclusion that there were five or maybe six personality traits which you can actually reliably measure. These are conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, and openness, which is also could be called culture or intellect. And the idea is that there's a sixth one, which is a combination of honesty and humility as well. And the idea is that if you grade yourself on these five or six different characteristics, you can get a rough approximation of your personality. And some psychologists have linked various personalities to various sorts of music. And to do this, they had to classify music into a very small number of titles. So we have reflective and complex music, which includes classical, jazz, folk, and blues. Intense and rebellious music is like rock and alternative and heavy metal. Upbeat and conventional music is pop, country and western, soundtracks and religious music. And finally, energetic and rhythmic music is stuff like rap and soul and electronic. So, it's been found that enthusiasts for reflective and complex music tend to score high on intelligence, but they're very poor at sports, they're good with words, and they're often politically towards the left. Fans of intense and rebellious music are also good on intelligence, and they're skilled with words, but they're usually good at sports.
And there are exceptions. There are exceptions here, right, John? Like, I like loud, raucous music, and I'm not what I would say good at sports exactly. So not everybody's fitting these cookie cutter categories.
No. This is a very general, broad brush thing. But you know, one of the interesting things here is that you can classify the music together into these broad genres. So if you do like, if you like rock, you're probably going to like alternative music as well. And if you like country and western, you probably like pop music and soundtracks as well. So there's an opportunity here to expand your taste in music.
Interesting. So if you like that, you might like the other, and it might fit well. Another thing you write about, and we've talked about some on the show before, is when we fix our musical taste, we tend to lock in at some point in our lives, and it can be hard to break out of that category. When do we tend to decide this is good music and anything after that is the awful stuff that the kids listen to these days?
Well, the strange thing here is that we lock into a lot of things between the ages of about 15 and 25, and music's one of those things. We also choose the sort of books we like reading and even the sort of toothpaste we use, which is very strange, but we tend to fall madly in love with certain sorts of music when we're in our late teens, and we retain that love, even though quite often later on in life our tastes change because we get a craving for more complicated music as we get older, simply because the stuff that we listened to when we were younger, we know so much about the genre that we can forecast what's going to happen next in the music, and it gets a bit dull for us. So you do find that some people who loved punk or heavy rock when they were 18, 19, by the time they're 45, they're listening to jazz and Beethoven. But we do retain that deep affection for the stuff that we fell in love with when we were approximately 20.
We're talking to John Powell. His new book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. I want to get into some music and the impact it has on people. I want to start by listening to a little Barry Manilow.
I remember all my life, raining down as cold as ice.
And John, a lot of people love Barry Manilow, so I apologize to them now. You write about this as an example of music used in New Zealand, I think, and elsewhere to drive young people away from loitering.
Yes, this is in Sydney, in
Australia,
in 2006. And what happened was, in that year, they had the city council had a lot of trouble with teenagers hanging around shopping malls. They weren't doing anything illegal, they were just hanging around. But the people who were trying to do the shopping found them a bit sort of in the way. And the city councillors tried various ways of getting rid of them. They tried getting the uniform guards to ask them to move along, but of course they weren't doing anything wrong, so why should they? They stay where they were. And then somebody had the brilliant idea of making the environment very uncool for teenagers. And these teenagers were all born in about 1990. So the most uncool music they could think of was Barry Manilow. And they started playing Barry Manilow through the speakers in the shopping malls, and the teenagers just evaporated. They disappeared within minutes and never came back. And this is because we all want to be cool. I want to be cool. You want to be cool. Because cool is just a shorthand word for how much acceptance you have with your peer group. But once you get above about 25, you're quite confident with the coolness you have, and you don't feel polluted by things that happen around you. But when you're trying to establish your level of cool, when you're 16, 17, 18, if anything uncool happens around you, you feel like it's going to contaminate your own cool.
Wow.
So you run away from it.
So mom and dad music has a contagion effect on me.
That's right, yeah. So being in an uncool place makes you less cool, and so the kids involved just disappeared. And it's a really good example of the power that music can have on our behavior.
Let's play some other examples. Here's one, I think, people loved it. I think it probably got uncool too. But here's Bobby McFerrin.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry.
So don't worry, be happy. And that's the effect it had on a lot of people. Why can some music like that Bobby McFerrin song, John, perk us up, make us happy?
Well, as I was saying earlier about this inner pharmacy that you have, there are all sorts of, well, we can call them drugs, if you like adrenaline and cortisol, serotonin and so on. And if you really like a piece of music and it makes you happy, and in that case, the lyrics are very happy as well, and it's rather a relaxed piece of music as well, and you can't be denied by anybody that it has a happy feel to it, then your blood supply starts getting more serotonin and dopamine into it, which is your happiness drugs. And so that will have on a lot of people who are just familiar with Western music, that particular track will make them feel happier in a genuine way. I mean, you can actually take blood tests of people and see that their blood chemistry is changing with the music. If you put something a lot more driving on, if you're falling asleep on a motorway, for example, and you put something really intense and driving on the stereo, you can give yourself a hit of adrenaline, and that will wake you up, make you pay more attention to what you're doing. And it's a genuine chemical change brought on by music.
I'm going to get a little personal here and play a clip of a song by a TV on the radio, Halfway Home. I'm going to point out a moment during it that I'll describe the emotional response I have to it. So first, the song, TV on the Radio. Here it comes. So, John, at that moment, and I still have this, even though I know it's coming, I tear up a little at that chord change. It hit me powerfully for a while, less so now. What the heck's happening in my brain there?
Well, something emotional must have happened in your life when you first heard it.
I was in the kitchen cooking, I think. Nothing big.
Well, I'm surprised. If that was the first time you heard it, I'm surprised, because when you hear a piece of music for the first time, you don't generally get the full emotional effect. It's usually a bit later. But we all get these emotional climaxes generally from changes in harmony rather than changes in the tune. And it's usually a subtle change that we didn't really expect. It was something better than we expected. And whenever in life, if we ever get anything better than we expected, we give ourselves a reward chemical, dopamine and serotonin, which says, oh, that was really good, we want to do that again. And that's why you retain the same, even though you now know it's coming. The first time it happened, it really gave you a big emotional response. But it's a sort of pleasure response you're given for having done something good to yourself. So it's a bit like the pleasure response you might get from being given a sandwich, because the sandwiches are obviously useful. But you also get a pleasure response when you're handed a sandwich, you know, 10 years later, because you know the sandwich is going to give you this pleasure response. The same with music. You don't need to be just surprised to get the pleasure response. You can get the pleasure response because you know it's coming. And as you were just saying then on the radio, you were saying, here it comes, here it comes. Well, actually, that's what your mind is doing before that happens.
It's a tasty brain sandwich.
Yeah, basically, yes. Your brain is designed to reward you if you have it. The first time you eat a sandwich, to tell you this is a good thing. But after that, your brain has this sort of pre-wired thing which says, a sandwich is coming up. This is going to be a good thing. And so if the music hit you in that way the first time around, then after that, you get the same pleasure response, but it's slightly earlier, and it's because it's coming up.
We're talking to John Powell right now. Watch for our new band, Tasty Brain Sandwich, in a club near you. His most recent book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you find that you gravitate toward certain types of music all the time, or maybe in certain situations, something to get you pumped up, something to calm you down? Are you aware of that impact that music can have on you? Is there a particular song you associate with a powerful moment in your life? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to John Powell. His most recent book is called Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What music really speaks to you? Are you committed to one genre, one particular artist? Is there a song that has a strong emotional impact on you, for better or worse? Why? Was it associated with, I don't know, a scene from real life or a scene from a movie? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Rich on the line in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Hi. I found a song a long time ago. Actually, William Orbit did a remake of Adeco. It was it's all strings, it's all violins, and your guest speaker might have heard of it, but it is so intense. I mean, it builds, and it used to be like this. They played it for the Elephant movie during the saddest moments when he was dying. And I heard it like all the other day again on YouTube, and I started playing it for friends, and they all agree that it's like the most beautiful piece, and it just touches your soul every time they hear it.
And you get an intense feeling when you hear it, Rich?
Man, I'm not even a crying guy. I do hospice care.
Oh, wow.
And I hear it, and when I hear it, it's like this, when the violins come to that peak, and it goes, doom, doom, and then they back off. And when they come to that peak, I had friends all hear it, and they all cry at that.
Wow. Rich, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And, John, music as a movie cue, it can have that powerful, often very sad feeling to it.
Yeah, film music can be very, very powerful because you have the impact of the visuals and the music at the same time. You could look at it this way, that the film provides you a sequence of events to get emotional about, and the music heightens all those emotions. And one strange thing is that you can actually get a bigger emotional effect if you play the wrong music before a climactic event. So that if you're watching a father looking for a child and the music's happy, and then the guy turns a corner and he finds that his child hasn't survived whatever it was, then the shock is much more basic and visceral. And similarly, if you've got some menacing music going on while he's looking for his child, and then suddenly the child's okay, then the relief is much greater.
Mm.
So movie composers actually play these tricks on us quite often, where they send us one way, and in fact the result is completely different, and it's quite a shock when you get that effect.
Rich, thanks so much for sharing that. Speaking of strings with a powerful impact, here's a very different use of strings in a momentous movie scene. Here's a listen. So the strings in Psycho, that's not the freakiest part of them there, but John, that's one that lives on in the memory and not in a, like, that's a get your heart beating in a bad way sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. The strange thing that happened with that one is that Hitchcock told the composer, Bernard Herrmann, not to write any music for that scene, but Bernard Herrmann ignored him and wrote some, and it's become the most iconic piece of film there ever been. If your listeners don't know the bit, I can't really sing, but he goes, ee, ee, ee.
Right.
Actually gets stabbed in the shower.
It's like scraping a chalkboard with a violin.
Exactly, yeah. He was trying to imitate the sound of human screaming, and he did a very good job with it. But the thing is that piece of music, that the ee, ee, ee scream bit, is so iconic now that in the film Finding Nemo, they used that music for the little girl Darla, who was a great danger to the fish involved. She's only a little kid, but she's dangerous to them. So whenever she appears, you get the EEE music to say, this is a point of danger.
We're talking to John Powell about the emotional power of music. We'll go back to our callers now with Brad in Portage. Brad, hi.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I was just curious. As far as classical music goes, I've noticed with a lot of the, maybe a child's swing or items like that are made meant for a little more of entertainment, they always have classical music options to be able to play as the swing moves back and forth. And I was wondering if that had more to do with the soothing effects of classical music, or if it was more in relation to if small children listen to classical music, they tend to have higher IQs when they grow up.
Brad, thanks for the call. So, yeah, classical music on kids' toys or kids' videos, things like that, is that something that actually calms kids down, John, or is this kind of an aspirational thing? Well, if they're listening to Mozart, their IQ will go up.
Well, there is a thing called the Mozart effect, which was published a while ago, and it does exist, but it has nothing to do with Mozart. It was misnamed. Basically, if you're about to do an IQ test and you do something which is A, pleasant, and B, slightly stimulating, like listening to a piece of happy piano music, then your IQ will rise because it stops you being sleepy, so you wouldn't. If you're sleepy before an IQ test, you're going to do badly, and if you're panicky, you're going to do badly. So if you do something nice, which is also slightly stimulating, you'll get your best score. And so they've investigated this, and while they were looking into it from the Mozart effect, they also found a Schubert effect and a Blur effect even, and even a Stephen King effect, because if you listen to a short story by Stephen King just before an IQ test, you also get a better score because you're slightly stimulated and you've enjoyed it.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Brad. We'll go next to Tony in Manistique. Tony, hi.
Hi there. How are you guys?
Good. What's your music story, Tony?
Well, my music story is I'm a child of the 70s and grew up listening to a lot of 70s music. And every time I hear the music these days, it brings back real vivid memories. I'm talking about almost like a film, a screen going past my mind, and I'm placing myself at those points. Is there any research that really plays upon that?
Yes, there's quite a lot of research onto this. It's generally stuff from when you were 18, 19, 20, 21 perhaps. I imagine this is the sort of period you're thinking about. And that is the time at which we start developing our own personalities. We start deciding what we want to read and what we want to write. What we want to listen to and so on. So you create your own personality at that point, and you have a lot of great memories because a lot of things happen for the first time. You have your first drink, you have your first kiss and so on. And so there are a lot of very big, important memories from that time. And also you've fallen in love with the music that you've helped create your own personality. I mean, if you were born in 1750 or 1810 and your parents were farmers or fishermen, there was no need to create a personality for yourself because that's what you were going to be. And everyone knew where you would be living and what you'd be doing in 40 years' time. But nowadays we have so many choices in life that we genuinely have to create ourselves, and we do that in our late teenage years with the help of our peer group. And part of that building process, and part of one of the things we use, is the music that our peer group love. So you get together with a gang of people who are your friends, obviously, and you choose a certain genre of music, and that's yours. And you might choose a certain band, and it can be a big disappointment if that band become mainstream during the time that you're enjoying them, because they're your band. But yes, you do identify very strongly with stuff from that sort of teenage years.
Tony, thanks for the call. As we wrap up, John, and briefly, I never want to be the person who says, oh, there's no new good music out these days, because I know there is. So are there lessons in how we can keep our minds open to the new stuff that's coming out and genuinely appreciate it?
Absolutely. If you pick a genre, any genre, you might pick Indian Bhangra music. It doesn't really matter. If you listen to it while you're doing the washing up or while you're driving the car and give it a few hours, just pick one CD or one playlist and play it 10 times to yourself, you'll start learning the rules of that particular piece of music. It's like learning a different language. It does take about 10 times, as I say, but then you'll start really appreciating it, because you need to have a certain knowledge of what's likely to be happening next if we start enjoying a new genre of music. But you could pick bluegrass banjo or brass band music, and you will almost certainly start to love it, and that will broaden your horizons musically.
And what are you discovering these days, John?
I'm still working my way through all the world music in the world. There's a lot of it.
All right.
But African acoustic music is something I'm looking at the moment. It's really beautiful stuff. You have to play, you have to work at it for the first few hours, but after that, it really is beautiful.
Fantastic advice. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on.
We've been talking to scientist and musician John Powell. He's the author of the book Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. And you can keep telling us your stories, what music you look back on with good memories, fondness, intense memories, or what you're discovering now at whatever age. Do that at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, join NPR for continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia with analysis and live broadcast of the big speeches. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, podcasts and documentaries in the last few years have highlighted the lives of people who were convicted of crimes on allegedly shaky evidence. But if those people are granted hearings or retrials and eventually exonerated, what happens next?
In a new book called Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, investigative journalist and author Allison Flowers looks at the lives of people who were exonerated after being wrongfully convicted of crimes. She follows the stories of people who had been exonerated after being convicted and shows the struggles of life after prison.
Here in Wisconsin, Jarrett Adams was exonerated in 2007 after a panel of judges declared him wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17. He'd served almost a decade in prison before being exonerated, and he's now an attorney with the Innocence Project.
Allison Flowers and Jarrett Adams join us now. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me as well.
Allison, I want to start with the thing you start your book with. You talk about how there's not even an entry in the dictionary for the word exoneree, other iterations of that word, but not for the person themselves. What does that say to you?
Well, that's right. As I started working on this project and interviewing real-life exonerees, I discovered that as I typed the word exoneree into my computer, it was coming up on spell check and emails and Microsoft Word, you name it. And we don't have a word for the person. There's no word for this growing community of people leaving prison innocent of the crimes that sent them there, even though right now, on average, we have an exoneration every 3 days in this country. And I think it really speaks to how forgotten and how invisible these people are and the lack of resources for them.
I want to get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about here. Do we know how many people are exonerated after being convicted today?
Somewhat. There is a tracker called the National Registry of Exonerations out of the University of Michigan. They've been looking at this for a couple of years, and they basically aggregate and gather as much information they can about exonerations as they happen. I think right now we're at about, we're getting close to 1,900 exonerations since 1989. But I believe, and I think they would say this too, that it's in no way comprehensive. It's not like when a case is overturned or a vacation is vacated that you know, a court or a judge or a lawyer or anybody sends out a press release, you know, or put some sort of notification out there that this has happened. So I think there are a lot of cases being overturned where the person is actually innocent, and we're not capturing those. So 1,900, there's about one every 3 days, but at the same time, there are a lot that we miss.
Jarrett, a lot of people saying, as Allison was getting at there, that they believe this number to be much higher than it actually is. Based on your story and what you've seen, do you agree with that projection?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that because, I mean, if you just think about it, that the technology hasn't really caught up with all of the cases yet, and it's just now getting there with DNA testing and, you know, just the court acknowledging that sometimes, you know, there is, you know, fault of the criminal justice system, you know, whether it be, you know, prosecutors making a mistake or missing this or missing that. And so it's anything man-made is bound to make a human error. So that's not the biggest issue. The issue is, okay, what do we do to correct it now? You know, how do we go back and how do we make sure that justice was ensured?
And Jarrett, you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York now, but this is also a story that you've lived. You've been through this. Can you tell us some of that journey from prison inmate to exoneree to lawyer? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I spent almost 10 years of my life in prison, so I was a very young man, you know, wrongfully convicted. You know, family didn't have resources like a lot of the cases where you don't have the resources to buy an attorney, you get a public defender. This isn't a knock on all public defenders because public defenders are overworked and underpaid, and so, again, the system is fallible and sometimes things happen. You know, it took me to get the help of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and Keith Finley to advocate on my behalf and get my conviction overturned, and, you know, my record was dismissed, and, you know, I don't have a record, but I come home a 26 turning 27 year old man with a 10 year gap in my resume, no credit history, no job skills. And so it was a very, very long road to go from someone who was, you know, wrongfully convicted, released, and then, you know, get off of my mother's couch one day and walk to school, enroll, and look, 9 years later, I'm graduating law school, taking a New York bar, and now I'm an attorney in New York. I may have made it look somewhat easy. However, it wasn't, and it took a lot of help, and it took a lot of things that I just wasn't afforded when I came home. And one of those things was just having a therapy. You know, it's like it's a traumatic experience to go through something like that, and you come home and you've lost so much time. And, you know, one of the best things that happened to me was being able to get on the couch of someone and speak to them and let it all out.
Are there structures in place, Allison, for people like Jarrett, who might be exonerated, but there's a time lapse there? They get out and it's not the same world as when they were convicted. What resources are there for these people?
Well, I think as Jarrett alluded, you know, there really are no resources. There's no aftercare for exonerees. There's nothing immediate for them. It's really a media myth that release from prison is this happy Hollywood ending. It's really not an ending. It's the beginning of another set of struggles. So when you leave prison as an exoneree, no matter where you are, you don't receive immediate compensation, not a dime. You don't even get a bus pass, which, you know, as many parolees will at least get that. There aren't any social services, no counseling, no medical, and your record is not automatically expunged. So you can't find work very easily at all. That's not to mention, you know, family members that may have died or moved on in your absence. And, you know, depending on where you were convicted, the state may or may not ever compensate you or compensate you very well. So there's still 20 states that do not offer any compensation. And many of the states that do compensate don't provide very much, Wisconsin being one of them. It's capped right now at $25,000 a year for $5,000 per year. And, you know, there was a bipartisan bill that was shut down this last legislative session that was trying to raise it to $50,000 a year for every year you were incarcerated and capping it at $1 million. And that, you know, that was not able to move forward. And so, you know, especially exonerees in Wisconsin and exonerees in those 20 states that don't have anything at all, you know, there are no immediate resources. You basically have to hope for something like a civil lawsuit, which, you know, few cases are poised to handle civil litigation. You have to have some unique circumstances in order to sue the state for millions of dollars. So those cases are just very rare, and most exonerees are left without any resources or very few resources.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers right now and attorney Jared Adams, who was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teen. He was exonerated in 2007. And I wonder about the effect of pop culture on exonerations and innocence projects. I'm thinking of Serial and Making a Murderer, taking an interest in people convicted of crimes who might have far fewer resources than people with more privilege. Jared, do you think that these cases are having an effect, are changing the legal system?
I mean, I do, and that's one of the reasons why I respect the work that Allison does and the book that she made, because it's one of these things where the more people who hear about this and who hear about this being very real, the more people who will be receptive to it and also who will be open-minded enough to say, you know what, push this legislation through. Because this isn't so much a thing now that we know that the courts are acknowledging it and you're seeing different coverages on it happening more and more. This isn't a thing that is you know, should be missed and it made about nothing but financial compensation. There's compensation that finances can never make up for. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, me coming home, it was very awkward to meet my niece and nephew at 9 and 7 years old. And, you know, we didn't know whether to hug or to shake hands because we never knew each other. And you can't make up for time like that. And I think that, you know, books like Allison's and these different series are bringing it to the living rooms of people who have never experienced this, may never experience it, and, you know, don't know anything about it. And so I think this is a very great topic to discuss. It's a real topic. And I think that we shouldn't shy away from difficult conversations in America. What makes us great is to take on these responsibilities to fix them and not point blame.
And Jerry, you said therapy helped you when you were exonerated. That was one of the elements that helped you make this transition. Now you're an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York. But I'm curious about what else you'd like to see to support people who go through this. It sounds as though there is no real compensation, but maybe there's more. Maybe you'd like to see something even more systemic before we get to that point. What are you looking for?
Well, if I had the magic wand, I would like to prevent these things from ever happening. However, I'm realistic, and I know that mistakes do happen. But like I said before, I would like to see the immediate reaction of, you know, these picking up the pieces of people's lives that are ruined because of this. So I don't want to see you coming home and you got to litigate as to why, you know, you should be compensated or given therapy or given health care. There are exonerees in Wisconsin, specifically Joe Fry, you know, who came home and, you know, he's at the age of retirement right now, but there's nothing for him to retire on. And that's just completely unfair, because what we're doing on the one hand in society is saying, you know what, we're not going to compensate you or help you, and we're going to dump you back onto society. And if you don't have a job, you know, if you're not able to provide for yourself, then you become the responsibility of the taxpayers again. And I think it's totally unfair, and we should do something collectively about it.
We're talking with investigative journalist Allison Flowers, and attorney Jared Adams is with us. He was wrongfully convicted of a crime as a teenager and was exonerated in 2007. He's an attorney in New York currently.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guests? Do you think the criminal justice system fairly compensates people who have been wrongfully convicted? What do you think should happen when somebody's in that situation? They're exonerated, released from prison. What should they get? What should happen? And do you work in the criminal justice system? Tell us what you think about the way exonerations and convictions are being handled. Call in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation with Allison Flower. She's a journalist, author of the book Exonerate Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Jared Adams is with us also. He's an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and was exonerated after serving about 9 years in prison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the criminal justice system, that state government, should do for people who are released, who are exonerated, who judges rule were wrongfully convicted for a crime and then spent years, maybe many years, in prison. Call in at 800-642-1234. Or have you had an experience or someone in your family with this side of the criminal justice system? The number again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Allison, we just heard Jarrett saying that ideally these convictions, these wrongful convictions, wouldn't happen in the first place. And I assume that's part of the goal here. What needs to happen to stop them before they happen?
Well, I think really two things need to be seriously looked at. One is police misconduct. I do think that there is a strong connection between official misconduct that you see among police and prosecutors and the number of people that are being wrongly convicted. I mentioned the National Registry of Exonerations, which tracks these wrongful convictions and exonerations. And because of the known cases, about 1,900 that are out there since 1989, we're able to examine the contributing factors to how those people were wrongly convicted. And one of the leading causes is official misconduct. So that could be, you know, police having tunnel vision investigations, prosecutors hiding evidence or not disclosing evidence that is favorable to the defense, those sorts of things. Also, you know, maybe incentivizing someone to testify against someone else in court. So the number one cause contributing factor to wrongful convictions would be perjury or false accusations. And that's basically as simple as someone lying about you in court. And so if we actually look at the gamesmanship that goes on in the courtroom, if prosecutors are more concerned about getting it right rather than making a deal with someone to testify against the person they really want to get and who, you know, is later as a consequence of that wrongly convicted, I think that would go a long way in preventing wrongful convictions.
Let's take a caller now. We have Natalie with us from North Prairie. Natalie, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question. I don't think it's been talked about yet, but when you think about the ramifications of these decisions on people's lives when they're in prison for such a long time wrongfully, and I think it is evident there's no amount of money to make things right. Are there professional ramifications for the people, whatever role they played in putting someone in prison wrongly, judges, police, lawyers, are they losing their jobs? Are they being disbarred? Because if it was me, that would bring me a little bit of a feeling of justice. And I can take my answer off air.
Natalie, thanks for that question. And what about that, Jarrett? Are there professional consequences for prosecutors, judges?
Well, I'll be completely... Well, thank you for the call, Natalie. Very rare. It's very rare. And it's a complicated situation, and it may be so complicated to explain, so I'll sum it up and say that it has to be something that is completely egregious for a prosecutor or an official to be held liable in their capacity. There are certain things that you can do as in your role as a prosecutor or as a police officer where you're protected by that role you did it in. You know, maybe you're investigating and maybe you do have tunnel vision. You know, maybe you really did believe a person was guilty, but evidence later proved that they weren't. That doesn't necessarily mean that you maliciously did something wrong. And it's kind of a loophole that needs to be fixed. And one of the things that I've been clamoring for the longest is I believe that there needs to be a separation between the police and the prosecutors. I don't think it's fair that they are able to have a relationship to where it's a working relationship and where the roles almost become the same. A prosecutor is able to participate in the investigation portion of questioning a person. And we've seen a whole lot of things in these cases that I don't think is fair. And I think that if you have a separate entity that is reviewing the evidence before it gets to the prosecution and then allowing the prosecution to prosecute solely on the evidence that has been presented in front of them, I think that you'll have a lot less tunnel vision. I think that you'll have a lot less turning the blind eye to misconduct by police. And I think that you'll have a better result in the system. And to also follow up on the point that I think Natalie made is, it's not just the person who's convicted. and who goes through the wrongful conviction that are suffering because of this. You're talking about family members. You're talking about coming home and you don't have a home. So you're asking your family to allow you into their home. And when you do that, you know, everything goes up, all the way from the light bill to the food bills to everything. And you're a grown man in many cases staying at your family's house with no insurance or nothing to contribute to the household.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Natalie. And let's take another call now. Christy is with us next in Madison. Hi, Christy.
Hi. What was striking me as listening to all of this is just Jared, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Jared.
That you were wrongfully convicted when you were so young. And it's incredible that you had the fight in you still when you got out. And you went and you got your college education, but it just struck me that, you know, that there's potentially other people who are in that same situation, and they basically got that early years to get their college education taken away from them, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and you went back and got your college education, and that's amazing, but you also had to do it later than other people.
Christy, thank you so much for that comment. And Jared and Allison, I'm going to ask you both to chime in on that briefly. Does some sort of compensation or fund need to be set up to allow for someone's education, especially if they're a non-traditional student? Maybe they're starting later. Allison, we'll start with you.
Yeah. Well, there's one exoneree in my book named James Kleppelberg, and he was actually serving 6 life sentences for murder when he was exonerated. So he was accused of setting fire to a home that killed a family of 6. And, you know, in his situation, he was in a position where the Department of Corrections never viewed him as ever getting out. So why would they educate him, right? So, you know, he came out at retirement age as well. And, you know, he likes to say that when he went in, there were floppy disks, and he comes out and suddenly people are getting emails on their phone. I think in terms of compensation, you know, there are some states that baked into their policies around exoneree compensation do provide for some measure of education. I think that would be a wonderful thing to include. But, you know, right now there's just the state-to-state compensation laws are not uniform. And I think advocates who are seriously looking at this problem are suggesting something similar to the Texas model, which Texas actually has one of the best compensation statutes in the country. They offer $80,000 a year for every year that you were wrongly convicted, or every year that you were incarcerated, and they offer that moving forward. So it's not just trying to compensate you for the time that you lost, but acknowledging that you have the rest of your life to live as well. And, of course, you know, a lot of people come clamoring to you, whether you're an exoneree who's been compensated or not. Again, most are not. But a lot of people come clamoring to you or access to that money. So getting a huge lump sum, while of course it's better than having nothing, can also bring its own complications. So ensuring that you have resources moving forward, you know, for education or just for living your life, retirement, and so on, is very important.
And we're out of time. Thank you both so much for joining us. Jared, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Allison, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
That was Jared Adams. He is a lawyer in New York currently and was convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17, then exonerated. He's now with the Innocence Project in New York. Also, Allison Flowers joining us, investigative journalist and author of The Exoneree Diaries. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.